The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
It's beautiful. So we've been looking today at this possibility of seeing experience simply as this confluence of conditions. And we've already seen that there are a number of maybe responses to this, but today we're in this section, we're going to unfold some additional implications of this conditionality of experience. We'll see, first of all, maybe at the top level, that some of these conditions we have control over, in a sense, and some of them, a lot of them, we don't. So this can take the wind out of the sails of the blame that we sometimes bring to things, either of ourselves or of others or of the world. You know, so there's that. But it can do a lot more also. There are many other implications of this conditionality that we'll start getting into. The fact that experience is made up of shifting, changing conditions, there's a term for that, which is emptiness. And sometimes people are concerned about this word emptiness, but that's really all it means, is that it's empty of an unchanging essence. It just has these conditions that go with it. So it doesn't need to be an intimidating word or concept. So in particular, of course, that means that the self is one of these things that is conditioned, changing, empty of an essence, in a sense. And so let's look at what can be unpacked from that. So we can acknowledge that in addition to these conditions, they're not just random conditions, they're actually constructed conditions. So the sense of self is made up of a conglomeration of physical and mental components that have been put together, essentially. They've been put together in some way. It's constructed. And so we can watch it come into being. I remember one time I was on retreat and I was doing walking meditation in the parking lot. And it was pretty far into the retreat. I was settled and I just, you know, I was walking by a row of cars back and forth. And I wasn't thinking about much except my walking meditation for a while. And then it was all very peaceful. And then I had this thought come through my mind, which was a memory that I had parked in that row of cars many days earlier coming to the retreat. And suddenly, when I looked at the row of cars, one of the cars looked different. It blossomed up out of this row of cars as my car. Oh, right, that one is mine. And it had been like just one more car for all this time. And then suddenly it was my car. And then, you know, there were all these implications of this special car. I like checked to see that the tires were still inflated after a couple of weeks and, you know, things like that. So it's like my whole mind was colored by the knowing in the background that one of these cars was mine. So it was a completely different mind state, in a sense. So if you're mindful, if you have continuous mindfulness like I did at that time, you can watch this process go on. It's fascinating, fascinating. And it changed, you know, it changed exactly, literally how I saw that row of cars. And so the self sense that we've been talking about is always like this. It always brings some change or distortion to experience, or it maybe it shrinks an awareness that was very large. It shrinks it down into having one part that's fixed or special in some way. That's what the self sense does. That's what it's like. That's what it feels like. So it's a process. It's being constructed in that moment. And when it stops being constructed, then you know, those qualities aren't there anymore, that distortion or shrinking or changing or shifting. So we don't have to be upset about this. Sometimes when meditators start exploring not self or emptiness, they get the idea that when the self is there, there's something wrong. Like, oh, you know, I'm seeing in terms of myself, and that's bad, or, and that's wrong, or, and I'm, you know, I shouldn't have done that. But it's conditioned. So we have a long-standing habit of seeing things in terms of the self. And anyway, sometimes it's beneficial to see things in terms of the self. Like at the end of that retreat, I had better know which car is mine if I'm going to leave. So, you know, it has use. So it's just one more thing that we can observe with mindfulness. It's the coming and going of the self. It gets built all the time. So this idea of a constructed nature of practice is important. It has implications for our practice, I should say. And so if we're constructing things anyway, why not construct them better? Why not construct them well? And this is what Diana pointed to in answering Uri's question is, you know, given all the things that there are there, all the conditions that are there, can't we choose ones that are useful to construct and that will flow along and, you know, kind of bring more well-being to ourselves and the world? And this is part of the training, is to learn to do this construct as well, in order that we can eventually not do it, but along the path we try to do it better and better. So we can start, you know, in thinking about this, we can start with the view or the perception that we bring to a situation. This is part of, say, the present inner conditions this that Diana was talking about. We have some view or perception that we're bringing in. And we can see that if we're bringing in a view of, I don't know, ourselves as not very compassionate people, then, you know, it would be natural that what would follow from that is that we would feel some combination, some blame in combination to the conditions of, you know, I couldn't connect with my friend and I'm a bad person, therefore. So you can see how it kind of gets constructed. So, however, this view or perception is something that is changeable. Actually, that's one of the areas where we have a little bit of ability to make a change. So this is what Rob Rubea says in Seeing That Frees. It may be that the view affects to some extent how the whole situation unfolds externally, for it is immediately clear that if the view softens, emotions and reactivities soften too. And this softening is naturally communicated into the whole mix of conditions. Then the web of conditions is different, and it may be different enough to sometimes affect the situation so that a different outcome ensues. It's just one little change that we can make among all these conditions that are present. But what if in this moment we were to soften our view or soften our heart in some way? That could help. May not change every single time, but sometimes, you know, that becomes one more factor in all the conditions, and it can change the outcome sometimes. So inner and outer conditions are all playing into a situation. Realizing this is part of right view, which is part of wisdom. So then, once we're starting to think in this way of having this influence, two things start to happen. First, since it's just a confluence of conditions, we're less likely to blame others and ourselves. We soften. It's just conditions. Of course, it played out as it did. It's not about them being a bad person. It's just, you know, that was what was there. And then more generally, though, once we understand conditions are playing together, we can start to care about creating the best influx of conditions that we can into a given situation. We can deliberately cultivate inner conditions that are going to be positive contributors to the situation that we're in. Why not? So you might not be surprised that some of the best inner conditions that we can cultivate in ourselves that help situations are the heart qualities, the Brahmaviharas. In particular, metta is a nice one that we can just have in the background a lot of the time. So I want to pause, though, and bring in a point that might need to be made explicit, which is that this idea, this understanding that, of course, metta would be the right thing to bring in out of to create the right inner conditions, it says that understanding emptiness, that is the fact that things are conditioned, leads naturally to care, love, and compassion. Because when we see what the conditions are, we want to do ones that are caring, loving, compassionate. Seeing emptiness helps us bring forth the heart qualities. A lot of people hear the emptiness teachings and they think, oh, that's going to be all about just cold, dry, you know, whatever. But I'm saying, no, actually understanding emptiness means you will become a kinder, more heartful person. It's natural. We'll take steps to heal our heart and connect with others when we understand conditionality. So at a very simple level, we can see that our own past conditioning has a lot of influence on how we see others. So we are contributing to what we see in them. It's not just how they are, it's how we are. What do they say? We don't see things as they are, we see them as we are. Yeah, so we can start to understand that in light of this teaching on emptiness. And this alone can create the space to be a little bit more open in a situation. And then, you know, let's keep unfolding. We can start to see that my relationship to this other person cannot really be separate from my own mind, right? So, for example, my relationship with Diana, I can never see her completely separately. I can't relate to her completely separately from my own mind. I have to use my mind to relate to her, right? How could it be otherwise? So that little piece of Diana that I'm able to see is somehow in my mind. And so why wouldn't I choose to relate to her as a friend with metta in some way? It's part of my mind. And so this choice of holding the other person in a kind way is a great default to have. If you don't have any further information, that would be a nice default. So this is, again, from seeing it freeze. When qualities such as generosity, metta, and compassion are strong, all perception is colored. We see beauty everywhere, in other sentient beings, in nature, in the most mundane and ordinary situations and objects. Things can seem to be lit from within themselves with a quality of love, peace, or joy. So we make our world. That's one more thing that's constructed, is our experience of our world. So it's not that, you know, this is also in a sense a contrived or constructed way of seeing things, but it's better than seeing in terms of myself, my blame, my problems, this other person not being the right thing, blah, blah, blah. So we can do things better. And so this maybe takes us back to this poem that was heard in the guided meditation, is that we have some choice about what we put on the altar. And we can put everything, ordinary things, ugly things, beautiful things. And there's a way in which that very process is enlivening, awakening, so beautiful that you would cry to just have everything be there, be right there on the altar. And yet there's a way in which nothing is even better than all of that. We're getting a little pointing toward the unconstructed or the deepest form of emptiness, which next time we'll start to touch into awakening and how it affects our, can color and saturate our Dharma life also. But this is left maybe a little bit open as a sort of a contemplation. What is on the altar? How are we building things? How are we seeing things? There's a huge amount of exploration to be done there through practice. And it's fascinating and it's increasingly liberating. So maybe I'll stop there and turn it over to Diana.
Thank you, Kim. Yeah, it's such a powerful teaching. Often we need to hear it a number of times too, and maybe in different ways or something. just this recognition that we might think that we are innocently perceiving or looking at things. But what Kim is talking about is, no, we're not as innocent as we think that, and we all know this, our mood, our the way that we're feeling, our views that we have affect what we are, what we're perceiving. We all know this, that things look different when we're tired and hungry than after we are in a great mood. So with this recognition that how the mind participates in our experience, how can we apply this understanding to suffering? How can we apply this to our experiences of suffering, our understanding of suffering, this recognition that we are participating, whether we realize it or not at the moment, we are participating in our experiences by the stance, the perspective, the view, the mood, all these kinds of things that the mind has. So I'd like to put you into small groups to talk about this. And even if you feel like, you know what, I'm not even quite sure what they're talking about, that's okay too. You can just say, well, you know, I don't know. This sounds interesting. I've heard this emptiness word being batted around. But if you feel like you have this understanding, like, okay, maybe I could simplify it to say, how does our mental state, recognizing that our mental state colors our perception, how can we apply that to our understanding experience working with suffering in particular? So put you into groups of three or four, and we can go like we did before with the way that Kim described it, with one person says one thing and then it goes to the next person and then to the next person and then to the fourth and then back around. So it's not a usual way of having a conversation, but and then why don't we go in the order of the last digit of your phone number, and we'll say that zero comes before one. And if two people have the same digit, then maybe you go do the second to last digit of your phone number, just as a way to make sure the introverts and the extroverts are all in there. So here's the question. Recognizing that our mind participates, constructs our experience, how can we apply that understanding to experiences of dukkha? Okay, so here we go. Thank you, Kim. She put it in the chat box and you'll have access to that when you're in the chat rooms. Okay, have fun. So welcome back, and would you be surprised if I said we'd love to hear from you guys? How was that? And if you'd like, you can include, how was it to be in the small group? You know, just to connect with people, maybe you've never even met before, and you're talking about something, maybe it was clear to you, maybe it wasn't clear to you, but just the experience of being in small groups to talk about Dharma. So you can talk about the format, or you can talk about the content. This idea of we are participating, we are constructing our experience, even though we often are thinking that we're completely innocent, quote unquote, but to realize that we're not, and how that might affect our view or our experience of dukkha. So if you want to raise your hand, welcome any questions or comments you might have. And it doesn't have to be about the small group. It can be about anything we've talked about today. Sheila, can you unmute yourself, please?
So actually, both groups it was wonderful to connect in the group and to share our experiences. I'd like to thank everybody, both groups. It's really wonderful conversations about dukkha and how we create our environment. And I think we really talked about how we actually in this moment create a future, and that we have the how we decide to be in this moment with ourselves or with someone else, right, impacts that sort of next moment.
That's right. That's right. You're pointing to such an, yes, thank you, Sheila, something so important, right? That there isn't, it just doesn't exist, anything that's completely independent, that, you know, wasn't caused by other things or that doesn't have consequences. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. And then recognizing that maybe it influences us without getting stuck feeling like, oh, it's all my fault. I have to blame myself, right? Without falling into that trap. Anybody else have a comment? Or Kim, would you have something you'd like to add? No? Any other comments? Yes, David.
I find work in the breakout rooms wonderful. I mean, it's really interesting to get the ideas from the yogis in the group. It's not always an easy process, though, to have a very heady question and to sort of be dropped into the room all at once. And my feeling in my body and my mind is sometimes like, just how I'm going to approach this subject in the time that we have is, it's hard sometimes because it's not an organic process. It's not rising slowly and then branching out and deepening in and whatnot. Just things are going very quickly to the heart of the matter. And so it's an interesting process. I value it. And I learn lots from the people that I work with here, but it's a challenging process in some ways because it's quite constrained in time and how much time we have to work with. So.
Thank you. Thank you, David, for saying that. This constraint, and not only that, you see the little timer ticking right down, and there's like this pressure, you know, you see this. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So maybe we can explore with different lengths of time or something. Yeah, thank you, David. Or easier questions, maybe, right? Phyllis, yes.
I find it interesting what David just said, because as part of the breakout room process, I really enjoy just looking in my mind of what is happening while everyone is speaking or having their turns, or and how it's so variable, but also there's such a common theme. So that there is that interconnectedness, but there's also a real sense of curiosity as to how it's going to play out.
Nice, nice. Thank you. And this is exactly what Kim and I have been talking about. You said this sense of curiosity. How is it going to play out? This is like Dharma life right here, right? We started talking about investigation, and here we're kind of talking about there's different conditions that cause things to unfold in particular ways. So thank you, Phyllis, for pointing that out. So
we'll
Dawn, and you'll be the last one.
Hi, thanks. I can relate a lot to what David said, and noticing my own suffering, right, my own dukkha, and being in small groups and interacting. But I love what, now I can't remember if it was you who said this or Kim, but it was, I have a note here, we can start to see that my relationship with another person cannot be seen separate from myself. That's the way I took it down, and I thought about it in the context of the small groups, and it's just being open-hearted in the groups and knowing that if I present that to the people around me, hopefully, at least in this group, I know that my words are met with the same open-heartedness, because there's a lot of self-judgment on what I say to people. So it's interesting. So I appreciate the opportunities to share in the small group, even though it can be quite difficult. And getting those questions and listening to others, and then when it comes time for me to do the question, I have no idea what to say. So
thank you, Dawn. Thank you very much. Kim.
Yeah, I can say that for myself as an introvert, sometimes it takes me a little while to have some response to a question, and also to kind of take in the people that I'm with. And so the breakout room can bring me into contact with all those parts of myself. But just like in line with what we're talking about, what we're exploring today, the Dharma is really participatory. And so it wouldn't actually serve as well if Diana and I just talked the whole time and you guys all got to sit there and take notes. That's nice. We did that in school maybe, but there's this way in which what we bring is part of the process. and it's fine, you know, whatever. Having that mindset of just being open with the people, whatever you bring will be fine then. It's kind of funny that sometimes you ask later, well, was it okay what I said, that thing? And they don't even remember that thing that you said. You've been stewing for hours about whether or not that was okay to say. And they say, I don't remember you saying that at all. So, you know, what sticks out for us is not the same as what sticks out for others. Okay, so lots to explore this week then in terms of this participatory nature of ourself and others and our interconnection. So our suggestion, and of course this will come in the email also, but our suggestion is to maybe try that idea that Diana presented of inner and outer, past and present, all the combination of those conditions, and kind of looking at that, using that exercise in some aspect of your life and seeing how it plays out, pick something where it would be easy to identify those four and just go through that process and see what that is. We're also going to send you a couple of readings, one of them that reviews the inner, outer self, past, present. So you'll have a write-up on that. You don't have to remember it from what we talked about today. You'll have that. And then plus also a story about emptiness that you'll see a monk dealing with that in his own practice. Okay, so we'll see you next week for our last session on awakening. We've made it. We're all going to awaken next week. So put it on your calendar. See you then.
You bye. Nice seeing you guys. Be well.
Be everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you, Diana. Thank you, Kim. Yeah. Be well, group. Bye. Be well, be well, be well.
Yes.
Thank you.
Good to see you all.